just says point blank, you have to pay contemporary session scale for this, recording scale, which puts it into astronomical figures, and no one can do this. Columbia Records has begun to do this with their contemporary master series because they can afford to do it, and because Bruce Lundvall, who is the president of Columbia, has a real sincere interest in that music. They also want to beef up their jazz catalog where it was weakest, which is in the bebop era, when they were recording a lot of stuff that very little jazz and nothing that had to do with that music, or hardly anything. So they can do it, they can afford to do it. The average small label cannot, of course. So there's a problem. I think what they ought to do is the union should decide that all this material, which is now coming out anyway, and about which they're doing nothing because they don't want to invest in the lawyers and in the trial proceedings and so on to stop it, because frankly, under the copyright law, even the new copyright law, everything is moot. It does not specifically address itself to those questions, and in any case, it can only cover things that have been done since the new law took effect, and the old law leaves it in limbo. And there's something in Europe called the Rome Copyright Convention. If you subscribe to that, which a number of countries do, it says any sound material more than 25 years old is automatically in the public domain unless there are specific restrictions on it. So they can go ahead and do it free and clear. What the union should do here is come to a reasonable agreement with people who want to put this material out, put the money in the trust fund where it will benefit the musicians' community in general, or make an independent arrangement with the leader so that he at least will get some payment. And he could then possibly arrange to take care of the surviving members of his band or their estates or whatever. Some so-called bootleggers have already done this without the union. They simply get in touch with the artists or their survivors and make an agreement with them. And that's very fair. I don't see anything wrong with that. And I wouldn't call those recordings bootlegs. But of course, the average consumer has no way of telling. Some of them say released by agreement with the estate of Coleman Hawkins or the estate of Hot Lips Page or whatever it may be. And if you see that, you can take for granted that at least some payment has been made. But it's a knotty problem, and I don't know what the solution is. The same thing is happening in the area of films, which circulate freely among collectors and even are on the market with no rights going to the performers or the writers or anything. Of course, there is an intense market in secondhand records, and the artist realizes no benefit from that. I think most artists, if they're doing reasonably well, would rather see some of their good work be out and available to the public if they just get...
See, now that's another thing with a bootleg, because if someone has a good quality cassette machine at a club, they might not be recording your best work anyways. It might, if they bootleg that, for instance, it might not be something you'd want everyone
that's
to hear,
another
that
aspect.
You'd want representing
right.
you.
Right. That's true. I mean, if it's something that's poorly recorded and captures the artist at a time when he was not really thinking about recording and just going through the motions, that can be damaging, certainly. But by and large, this material is either of great historical interest or of considerable musical value. And there it becomes a real problem.
Maybe we can hear another one of the recordings, Dan Morgenstern, that you brought with you this afternoon.
Well, this is one of my all-time favorites, a marvel of a musician who is now 68 years old but still plays four nights a week at Jimmy Ryan's in New York and also goes on tour for Norman Grant's and still recording and still puts as much into his playing as he ever did, which has been a great deal, and that's Roy Eldridge. And recently, Verve, which now belongs to Polydor Records, in their reissue series, and that's quite a nice one, have brought out, under the title of this tune, a two-record Roy Eldridge set, which captures him in very good form in the 1950s. This one was done in 1953 with Oscar Peterson on organ, and it's blues, and it's Roy all the way through, and it's called Dale's Wail.
Thank you.
Roy Eldridge with Oscar Peterson on the organ. And this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest is Dan Morgenstern, who has joined us this afternoon from the Institute of Jazz Studies. Well, listen, we've spent a lot of time talking this afternoon about some of the things you've done within jazz, some of the things you've listened to, some of which you've brought with you and shared with us this afternoon. What are some of the things you've been listening to now? What are some of the who are some of the musicians in jazz, some of the new jazz recordings that you find really exciting you now?
Well, naturally, I brought along more records than we got to play, but one of them was something by the Lee Konitz Nonet, a nine-piece band that Lee has been working with on and off over the past 4 or 5 years or so. And that is a very exciting and original concept. And Lee and Ronnie Cuber, who is a marvelous baritone player, are really come out well in those things. The records are on small labels. There are two of them, and they're very hard to find, unfortunately. I've been interested in a lot of the very interesting new players who've been coming up out of the sort of second wave of the Chicago AACM group, two trombone players who are excellent, George Lewis and Ray Anderson. There are people like Arthur Blythe, who is a very gifted player. And then there are other people who play entirely different music, whom I like, Warren Vache and Scott Hamilton, who are sort of like throwback to mainstream jazz. And there's a lot going on. I think the music today is very broad, and it's not as it was perhaps when the Coltrane influence was at its height, where there was one sort of main stream that you could identify. Now there are all kinds of people playing all kinds of music, and it's very diversified, which I think is good, and it's very interesting, and it's all out there, and I don't believe in categorizing the music too much. I enjoy great players, good players, sincere players, regardless of what style they might play in. There's even some so-called fusion music that I find very interesting. But the thing is that there is a diversity of music out there and a lot of good music. There are old people. At the Newport Festival this time, one of the concerts, the American Song, one of the highlights were two gentlemen, Vic Dickinson, who is 73, and Doc Cheatham, who is 74, doing a delightful vocal and instrumental duet on a song called I Want a Little Girl. They brought the house down, and it was just lovely to see these venerable grandfathers, you know, still playing. And then you have the young kids, and it's beautiful.
Well, Dan Morgenstern, we are out of time. I hope sometime in the future you can come and join us again on Fresh Air. It's been a great pleasure having you here today.
It's been a great pleasure for me, and thank you for inviting me.
Dan Morgenstern has joined us today from the Institute of Jazz Studies. He's the director of the program. It's an archival program there. They have an extraordinary collection of 78s and albums, plus print materials. What I'd like to do is just give you the phone number again, in case you want to do some research that would involve going there. You can reach the Institute at area code 201-648-5595. Dan Morgenstern has also written extensively about jazz. You will find much of his writing on many albums that he's written liner notes for, some of which he's won Grammy Awards for. He's also writing a book on jazz that will be published sometime in the early 1980s. Dan Morgenstern, thank you again for joining us.